Good morning. Good morning.
Welcome to the Osteopathic Medical Board of Surgery and Medical Examiners on Saturday, May 20th, 2023, at approximately 11:44 a.m. Welcome. My name is Dr. Gary Erbstoser. I'm currently the president, and to my left is Dr. Maiden, the vice president. We are happy to be here today. Let's go on to call to the order. Mr. Bohol?
Yes. Roll call, Dr. Oda.
I am here, sir.
Dr. Walker?
Here.
Mr. Berg is absent. Mr. Goodman?
Here.
Dr. Shippon?
Here.
Thank you.
Can you hear me?
Dr. Mina?
Present.
Dr. Erbstoser?
Present.
You have a quorum.
Thank you. The mission of the board is to protect the public by setting educational and training standards for licensure and reviewing complaints made against osteopathic physicians, interns, and residents to ensure that their conduct meets the standards of the profession defined by law ARS 32-184. Call to the public. We'll move to item 3B. If any member of the public who is not a respondent or licensee or applicant or complainant wishes to address the board on a matter that appears on the agenda, you will be asked to speak during the call to the public. If you want to address the board on an issue not on the agenda, you will also be asked to speak during the call to the public. All those wishing to speak should contact the board member staff at this time. Anybody, Mr. Bohol? Okay, thank you. Moving on to item 4A, review and consideration and approval of minutes. 4A, March 17, 2023, open session.
Motion to approve.
Do I have a second?
Second.
All those in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Those opposed? None.
I have abstained.
Yeah, you have to abstain from Mr. Goodman. On 4B, March 7th, 2023, executive session. Do I have a motion for approval?
Motion to approve.
Motion is approved. All those in favor, say aye.
I need a second, sorry.
Oh, second? Dr. Oda seconds. All those in favor, say aye.
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 Aye. Moving on to item 5A, review and discussion and action on investigative hearings pursuant to ARS 32-1855, 5A, DO-22-0137A, Dr. James Tooley.
Dr. Tooley, I believe you're present. Are you represented by legal counsel?
No.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Tooley. And you don't have any legal counsel. Is the complainant here?
The complainant has not signed in this.
Okay. Can we swear in Dr. Tooley, please?
Dr. Tooley, please raise your right hand. Do you swear under penalty of perjury to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
It's awesome. We're having some technical difficulties. Please.
Sorry, Dr. Tooley, can you repeat that?
I do.
Thank you. Okay.
Okay. Dr. Tooley, is he on the screen? There he is. Can you give us just a brief summary of your education and currently what you're doing, please?
I attended the University of Arizona for my undergraduate education. I went to Kirksville College of Osteopathic Medicine and graduated in 1986. I did a general rotational internship at Oklahoma Osteopathic Hospital in Tulsa. And I've been in private practice in Tucson since the end of 1987. Just recently, approximately 6 months ago, I joined, I left chiropractic and joined Optum Care in the primary care clinic in Tucson on Grant Road.
Can you say that again, Dr. Tulley? I had a hard time please.
Do you need me to repeat that? I'm sorry.
Yeah, would you please just speak up a little bit?
Sure. I went to the University of Arizona for undergraduate. I attended Berkshire College of Osteopathic Medicine from 82 to 86.
Dr. Tulley, we just need the last thing that you said about what you're doing, please.
Oh, I'm sorry. So I've been in private practice in Tucson since 1987, and just recently, approximately 6 months ago, I joined Optum Care in their primary care clinic on Grant and Swan Road in Tucson.
Great. Glad to hear that. Whose case is this, Mr. Bohol?
Dr. Brock, can you please present the case?
Yes. This case came to us as a malpractice complaint. The malpractice alleged that Dr. Tulley failed to notify a patient with critical lab values, which resulted in her death. The malpractice documents note Dr. Tulley failed to train his staff with the terms critical lab values or critical results. They note he also withheld information that his office had received a fax report of the lab on July 25, 2018 at 9:53 a.m. It was reported in the malpractice complaint he received many faxes each day, and they were not reviewed for days at a time. This case involved a 46-year-old female that was first seen in Dr. Tulley's office on May 19, 2016 for anemia, blood in her stools, and swelling of her legs. Dr. Tulley did not document a physical exam, but assessed that she had anemia and edema in the lower extremities and noted that she may need a Doppler. She returned on April 5, 2017, noting she had recently had plastic surgery. She had had a gastric bypass as well as a breast lift and implants. Again, Dr. Tulley did not document a physical exam, but assessed that she had a heart murmur, edema, and anemia, and ordered an echocardiogram and lab work. The lab work returned that the hemoglobin was 2.9 and a hematocrit of 12.8. There was no documentation of the patient being directed to the ED in the progress note, but the patient did go to the ED on April 6, 2017. She was admitted to Carondelet Health and with severe anemia and transfused. She was discharged on April 9th. She was referred to a hematologist, and she was seen by Dr. Tulley three more times. She was last seen by him in the office on May 13th, 2017. And then on July 24th, 2018, she went to the emergency room at St. Joseph Hospital in Tucson with nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, neck, and back spasms. Her symptoms improved with IV fluids and pain medications, and she was discharged to home to follow up with her PCP. She indicated that her PCP was Dr. Tulley. Blood cultures were also obtained. On July 25th, the next day, the blood cultures returned with gram-positive cocci and chains. A medical technician from the emergency room called Dr. Tulley's office on July 25th, 2018 at 9:51 a.m. and spoke to his MA. The result was also faxed to his office at 9:53 a.m. On July 26th, which was the following day, the patient's family found her with an altered mental status. She was taken back to the ED by EMS after intubation in the field. She was found to be septic, coded within 2 hours of returning to the ED, and was not able to be resuscitated. The autopsy revealed group A sepsis with myocarditis. In the medical records, there also is the depositions of the both Dr. Tulley as well as his MA. And it seems that the MA did not know what critical lab values meant, and she did not, even though he was in the office, she did not realize that she needed to emergently tell him about it. She said that she felt because they were going to send it by fax that it would be dealt with by someone in the back office. And Dr. Tooley did not know about the critical lab value until he received a phone call from the ED stating that the patient had passed away. The deviation from the standard of care staff noted was that Dr. Tooley and his staff failed to notify a patient of critical lab results. Dr. Tooley failed to train his staff and develop policies regarding the handling of critical lab values. And also, I noted that no physical exam was documented on any of the patient's office visits.
Thank you, Dr. Cross.
You're welcome.
Dr. T, would you like to comment or listen to questions?
Thank you, Dr. Moon. Dr. Tooley, could you give us a little summary of what you think regarding our review, and then I'll open questions to the board members.
Yes, thank you. So I had not seen this patient in my office since 2017. Apparently she had been ill when she was on vacation in San Diego. When she came back to Tucson, she was sick enough to go to the emergency room. I was not contacted at the time. I was not contacted by her or by the emergency room when she was there. Blood work was done, exam was done at the exam, at the emergency room. At that time, she reported that she was having neck pain, back pain, nausea, and vomiting. Her lab at the ER showed an elevated white count with increased bands and low platelets. She was apparently sick enough for them to order blood cultures on her. But she was still sent home with instructions to contact me the next day, apparently, to let me know what was going on with her. That apparently didn't happen. That was on July 24th. The next day was July 25th. That was the day that she was told to contact my office to let me know how she was doing. Apparently her sister or her aunt at the time called her and she said she wasn't feeling much better, but she didn't feel well enough to call my office. So I did not hear from her that day either. The next day, that same day, I'm sorry, the 25th, we received a call, from the lab at St. Joseph's Hospital telling my medical assistant that there was critical labs on a patient and that he should write them down. They did not say life-threatening. They didn't say that she should let the doctor know immediately. And quite frankly, it was the first time that I can remember in my 30-some years that I was not contacted and spoke to directly regarding critical or any kind of life-threatening lab values. I mean, I've gotten called multiple times in the middle of the night from labs tell me that there's critical labs and make me repeat them. I'm sure all the doctors on the board today have had that same experience. So according to even St. Joseph's own lab guidelines, any critical lab is supposed to be called directly to the physician who ordered it or his contact, which would be the PA man, Tenton, who saw her in the ER that day, or the group that he works for at St. Joseph's. And also, it is the guidelines of all labs that I know of, that if there's a critical lab, something that's life-threatening, those labs should be spoke to directly to the physician himself, or a nurse practitioner or maybe a physician assistant who has the ability and the knowledge to know what a critical lab is. My medical assistant who works at the front of our office and is a very busy girl apparently wrote these things down, but then got so busy that she never did contact me about it, which is unfortunate, but that is the case, and that's why anything that's life-threatening should obviously be directed to the physician himself. The fact was in one of, you know, probably 100 faxes I get is obviously not an acceptable way to send a critical lab to a physician. So in this case, unfortunately, I never saw the patient. I didn't order the lab, and I wasn't contacted directly regarding the lab values, which unfortunately then led to this lady's demise. If I would have been contacted and told, all I could have possibly done was to call her home and hopefully get a hold of someone there and tell her to go back to the emergency room. Unfortunately, what happened was that she was seen in the emergency room. She was already showing some signs of septicemia, it sounds like. She also was noted in the emergency room to have a heart murmur, which could have been some early signs of endocarditis or myocarditis. And instead, she was sent home. And that is, unfortunately, what's happened in this case. And I don't feel responsible for the negative outcome because I didn't see the patient originally. I didn't order the lab test. And I wasn't personally contacted and told what the lab values were.
Thank you. I have one question for you. How do you explain not documenting or did not perform a documented physical exam in your office notes? I mean, I think even the first time you saw her, you should have had a documented physical exam assessment and plan.
Yeah, absolutely. So the physical exam is always performed. Unfortunately, sometimes when I get busy, I will dictate that at a later time. Sometimes those don't get onto the note. I just don't think it was accompanied with the note at this time. It must have been in there somewhere. The first time we talked, I saw her. I remember the case because they called me in the lab, spoke to me directly, and told me that her hemoglobin was 2.9. I remember that because that doesn't happen every day. And at that time, I did call her. We were able to get hold of her, and she was sent to the emergency room immediately.
Lastly, do you know the cause of her anemia?
She had a gastric bleed. I'm not sure if it was due to some consequence of her gastric bypass or not. But she was transfused by apparently multiple times. And then after that, to follow up to make sure that it was not some other cause of anemia, such as inability to absorb iron, I sent her to a hematologist. And I didn't see her again for that problem in the office that I recall.
All right, thank you. I'm going to open questions to the board members, please. Anybody would like to comment?
I have a question for Dr. Tooley. Dr. Tooley, you have a new practice owned by Optum. How much control and management do you have of that practice, and how do you manage critical lab values at this time?
Well, as far as I know, all lab values that are critical are still to be relayed directly to the physician himself, especially the physician who ordered the test. Unfortunately, in this case, I wasn't even aware the patient was seen in the emergency room, let alone know that she had blood tests ordered. If she would have called me that day and let me know that she was in the emergency room and she had blood tests done and that they did do blood cultures, then, you know, I would have had somebody call over there and try to get the results just to make sure that everything was okay, especially because she said she wasn't feeling better. In fact, I probably would have told her to go back to the emergency room at that time. But that did not happen. But yeah, it's my understanding that any, you know, accredited lab, that a critical lab value is to be relayed directly to a physician who has the knowledge to make the determination then of what further treatment the patient needs, not just the medical. And that had never happened in my practice over more than 30 years. I cannot remember that ever happening before until this instance.
And in your current practice with Optum, do you have some sort of administrative ability to help correct items if need be? If you were to go back on Monday and find that this process isn't in place, do you have the authority to make those changes?
Well, yeah, maybe not me specifically, but I would tell the medical director there that this was not done appropriately and that we need to make sure that that the any kind of critical lab is relayed directly to the physician itself. But quite frankly, that is a laboratory mistake. As once again, the fact is that they are directed, according to the guidelines that I've seen, to relay any critical lab directly to the physician who ordered it, or one of his partners that can make a decision medically, is trained to do that on what's critical and what is not, and then where to go from there.
Thank you.
Any other board members like to comment?
Yes, sorry, my computer just powered down too. Doctor, you are below the standard of care for failing to maintain medical records in an adequate fashion, and you're below the standard of care for supervision of your staff. The person who called with the blood cultures did make appropriate attempt to contact. Were you there at the clinic on that day that medical assistant received that phone call?
I was.
So you're in the same structure. The person did not even have to make a phone call or track you down. The information's there. The faxes were received. It's your responsibility to make sure you review information in a timely fashion. If you don't have the ability to review the information, then you have to change your process. You can't let information that is potentially medically critical build up in that fashion. That's unacceptable. I don't appreciate you shifting blame. That was not a physician calling you. It's a process from the lab. Where a technician, if I remember correctly, is how that process works, makes an attempt to contact you. They call your office. It's your choice that somebody decides who answers the phone, which I totally understand. I actually answer the phone in the emergency room sometimes, too, because it gets busy, even though it's not my job. But if I don't answer the phone, which I frequently don't because I'm a physician there, somebody will grab me and tell me. The word critical is critical. Somebody does not have to say critical and get a hold of the doctor immediately. If you're on an aircraft and somebody tells you a process is critical, that passes in a reasonable fashion that a reasonable person would understand the information is important. This is your failing, not the lab's failing, and I don't appreciate you continuing to bring up that it's somebody else's fault.
Well, I understand your point, but according to the guidelines and our expert witness who runs multiple clinical labs, they have told me that any critical lab, okay, that could potentially be life-threatening should be communicated directly to the physician. And that's what I have seen in the past. Medical assistants, I don't believe, can tell the difference between severe, abnormal, critical, very abnormal. That's, I'm not sure if that's really their job. Anything could potentially be life-threatening, but in this case, it was.
Doctor, can I interrupt you for just a moment? I apologize. If a layperson was given the word critical, do you think that layperson would think that was important?
They would say it's very important.
Right. That's where the conversation ends. Thank you. I appreciate your attempt to comment.
Thank you, Dr. Mayor. Mm-hmm. Other board member questions? Concerns?
Dr. Tooley, there was a time period, and I think you may have mentioned this earlier, where you last saw the patient in 2017, and then they showed up in the ED on 2018. The patient saw you May 13th, 2017, with night sweats, anxiety, joint pain. You started her on Cymbalta, and it appears to me that was the last time you saw her. I'm just curious because this, at least from what I can tell, this is a type of patient I would probably put on higher surveillance just because she's so chronically ill. What was your, how did you lose follow-up with her? Did she cancel appointments, or was there no follow-up set after that May 13th visit?
Anybody I would start on a medication like Cymbalta, I would usually have them come back in 4 to 6 weeks. Because I usually start them on a low dose, say 30 milligrams. And I usually have them come back in 4 to 6 weeks to follow up, to determine whether they're doing well or if need to be, the dosage needs to be increased. So she, I'm sure that she was instructed to return in 4 to 6 weeks, but apparently she did not.
Oh, so at that time, was it not standard practice to set appointments before they leave the office?
They have that option.
Oh, I see. So, okay. I see. Okay, thank you.
So, Dr. Tooley, this was back in the day when you would dictate your notes?
Yes.
Okay, and then your labs would come through the fax machine?
Yes.
And did you have in place a protocol for the staff? Because you're not going to go through those at the time every day. You're going to have the staff go through them, and then they're going to put them on your desk. So did you review labs every day?
Not necessarily.
And if you do review labs, would you pick a day that you would do that, twice a week, three times a week?
Yes, probably twice a week, you know, maybe Wednesdays and then on the in the weekend.
Now, it was not a very good system, that's for sure. I mean, even when I was in that realm of, you know, having to dictate how do we get the labs and when do they come in, I made sure that I would at least see him once a day or maybe the following day, but I would review the labs to avoid this kind of a problem. Okay, Board.
Dr. Tooley, with the Cymbalta, that Dr. Odom brought up just previously, did you give her more than 6 weeks of medication so that she didn't have a need to come back in 6 weeks, or how did that work?
Something like that, I would usually give 1 month with maybe two refills so that they would be coming back, calling if I didn't get back from them, you know, and that's how I'd handle some of the back to the medication.
Okay, so she must have just quit taking it or gotten it somewhere else if she continued.
Apparently, yes.
Thank you.
Just a question for the other board members, since there are several in primary care, and Dr. Dooley, I do not do that, so I need to get some information from them also. What is your opinion on the supervision of his office staff and his review of the information that comes across via fax or other means?
Well, I agree with you. I think it was a standard of care issue. And it's okay because he's an Optum, he's got an EMR, he can document everything. The fact is, at that point in time, it was faulty.
If nobody else has questions, I'd like to make a motion to move to executive session.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
We're going to go into executive session for legal advice, Dr. Dooley, which will be back shortly.
I'm sorry, I can't hear that.
All right, we'll be back shortly.
All right, this is Dr. Herbstos. We're back in open session from executive session for legal advice. Just have one kind of observation or maybe a potential concern for Dr. Tooley. As you know, that when you're in a busy practice, you're going to have people constantly coming in and talking to you about questions, concerns, patients' vitals. I'm a little concerned that the person who was told about this test, this blood test, I'm concerned that she didn't relay it on because maybe she had some issues in communicating with you. Can you comment, you know, how was your relationship with the staff members?
I think our relationship is excellent. In fact, the young lady who's in question here has worked for me for, I think, 22 years. She's a hardworking, intelligent young lady. But unfortunately, in this case, once again, I don't really realize what they were telling her. And secondly, she's very busy at times and got sidetracked before she could give me the information.
Thank you. All right, opening it to the board members, board member for recommendations.
Mr. President, I'd like to make a motion for a decree of censure citing 32-1854-21 for inappropriate or lack of maintenance of medical records, as well as 32-1854, paragraph 34, lack or inappropriate direction of collaborative staff, and also 32-1854-39, conduct or practice that endangers the patient or public health. I would like to make a recommendation of CE. I'll ask my staff as far as number of hours that would be appropriate for this. This would not go on for continuous of your licensure medical or CE requirements, but this would include maintenance of medical chart and supervision of staff. That is my motion.
We have our motion. Do I have a second?
Dr. Oda, I will second that motion.
Dr. Oda, second.
May I clarify? The CE would be an order for disciplinary education. Is that correct?
That is correct. Thank you.
And you do need a roll call. Thank you.
Before we do a roll call, can I ask Dr. Prow or Justin, would that be 8 hours of CE or what would be an appropriate amount for those subjects?
You typically do 8 to 10 hours per subject. So it would be, if you wanted both documentation and supervision, we would recommend 18 to 20 hours.
18 is fine. Thank you. Is that okay with you, Dr. Oda?
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. We have a motion on the floor and second. Have a roll call vote, please.
Dr. Oda?
Yes.
Dr. Walker?
Yes.
Mr. Goodman?
Yes.
Dr. Chiffon?
Yes.
Dr. Matem?
Aye.
Dr. Herbstos?
Do you have any questions regarding anything else you want to discuss? You can get this information by communicating with our board executive, Mr. Bullhall. Do you understand?
Not completely. So do I contact someone and they'll instruct me on to the continuing education requirements? Is that correct?
That's correct, Dr. Tooley. You can call me next week, and we can speak about your options. You'll also receive a written summary of what happened today.
Okay. All right. Well, Mr. I appreciate
Bullhall,
that.
Could you tell them the degree of censure, what that means?
Mm-hmm. Just Dr. Herbst was asked, should I clarify what a decree of censure is? Decree of censure is the one of the lowest levels of discipline that the board can impose. It means that the board did find a violation in your conduct. It does address that maybe you have taken action to remediate that, but the board has to look at the action that occurred and find a way to remediate it. That's why they've addressed it with continuing education. And I can speak to you next week about the specifics of the CE.
Thank
okay.
you, Mr. Ball.
Do you understand, Dr. Tooley?
I mean, I do. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much for coming today.
Thank
All
you.
Right. Let's, you're welcome. Let's move on to item 5B, DO-19-252A, Dr. Cesar Rodarte. Are you here?
Yes. Yes, we're present, Chair Sponsor, this Plenary Council.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. Is the complainant here?
Yes. Can I hear that? I can't hear their stopping.
No, yes. The complainant, the person who wrote
the complaint.
Oh, no.
No, okay. All right, can we swear in the doctor, please?
Dr. Rodarte, please raise your right hand. Do you swear under penalty of perjury to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
Yes.
Thank you. Okay. Real quick, Doctor, can you please just give us a quick summary of what you're doing now and a brief summary of your training?
Yes. I'm a PO, family physician, surgery 1981 from College of Catholic Medicine and Surgery in Des Moines, Iowa. Actually, 79. Finished internship in Kansas City, Missouri. Did I'm board certified in family practice by the ACOP. I've been in practice 42 years. I had my group practice for 40 years. I sold the practice to a different group, worked for them for 2 years. That group is Phoenix Medical Center. And now I'm working for Village Medical in Gilbert for the last approximately 6 months.
Working for you. Who again? Because I didn't quite catch that.
That I'm working now for Village Medical for the last 6 months. In Gilbert, Arizona.
You're not in your own private practice?
Not anymore, sir.
So you did this transition about 6 months ago, is that correct?
Well, I made the transition about 3 years ago when I sold my practice to Phoenician Medical Center.
So 3 years ago, not
yes,
six
sir.
Months ago.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Can I have a review of the case, please?
Yes, sir. The complaint is the clinical director of Destiny Behavioral Health and Residential Care, which is a drug and alcohol treatment facility. The complainant states a male patient, patient KM, came to their facility for treatment on November 22, 2019, after hospitalization in a detox facility for alcohol and Xanax abuse. She states the patient had also been on methadone for 18 months and had been admitted to detox facilities multiple times in the past. She states the patient overdosed and was found obtunded. She states a prescription bottle was found showing he had been prescribed Ativan 2 milligrams number 60 by Dr. Rodarte on November 25, 2019. The patient had taken 30 of the 60 tablets in a 6-hour period. They also found Xanax number 30 on his person as well. The complainant feels Dr. Rodarte did not fully investigate prior to prescribing to this patient. After review of the case and the CSPMP, it does not appear that Dr. Rodarte prescribed Ativan 2 milligrams number 60 to any patient on November 25, 2019, but he did prescribe Xanax 1 milligram number 60 to this patient on that same date. Patient KM, a then 26-year-old male, was admitted to Destiny Behavioral Health Residential Care on November 22, 2019. He had recently been discharged from a local hospital after a 9-day detox from alcohol and Xanax. He stated he had been drinking 8 to 9 beers per day. He admitted to abusing alcohol, opiates, marijuana, and cocaine in the past. He had been in rehabilitation facilities 5 times since the age of 15. He had a past medical history significant for major depressive disorder, ADHD, generalized anxiety disorder, alcohol use disorder, opiate use disorder, marijuana use disorder, and PTSD. His medications at that time included methadone and benzodiazepines. He agreed he would be treated for at least 6 months. Later that same day, the patient stated that he had an appointment in Mesa with his primary care physician to refill his Xanax. The staff noted he had not been discharged from the hospital on Xanax, and he had just been detoxed from both alcohol and Xanax. The patient insisted that he had high anxiety and needed to restart the Xanax. It was noted the patient was agitated, belligerent, and upset about not being able to take Xanax during his treatment. On November 24th, the next day, the staff attempted to administer a urine drug screen, but the patient was unable to provide a sample. On November 25th, 2019, staff arrived to administer a urine drug screen, but felt the patient was intoxicated. He was difficult to arouse, and when he awoke, he could not walk. Staff attempted to arrange transportation to the hospital, secondary to suspected drug intoxication, but the patient refused transport. He was reported to be aggressive and agitated. He took off his hat, and a baggie of 30 Xanax was discovered. He showed a prescription bottle in which he had obtained then legally, but the prescription was for 60 pills. 911 was called, and the Phoenix police then transported the patient to the emergency department. Board staff subpoenaed Dr. Rodarte's office for patient KM's medical records multiple times, but the office and Dr. Rodarte stated these records could not be located. The records finally were located and provided to board staff, but not until December 14, 2022. These records showed that patient KM was first seen in Dr. Rodarte's office on November 26, 2018 for refills on his medications and complaints of anxiety. He was seen multiple times throughout that year, and then on November 25, 2019, Dr. Rodarte noted that the CSPMP was queried and showed the patient had received Xanax number 30 from a different provider earlier that month. The patient stated he wanted to taper off the Xanax. Dr. Rodarte prescribed Xanax 1 milligram number 60. And this is the same day that the patient overdosed. The patient then returned to Dr. Rodarte a month later, approximately on December 23rd, 2019, again for refills. Dr. Rodarte noted in the record that he discussed with the patient the ED visit that had occurred on November 12th. The patient denied that he had been seen in the ED or been admitted for drug abuse. Dr. Rodarte advised the patient to start to taper off the Xanax. He prescribed another number 30, 1 milligram Xanax, to assist with his withdrawal from Xanax. He performed a urine drug screen. This urine drug screen was positive for methadone, but was negative for benzodiazepines. And this was the only time during the whole time that Dr. Rodarte saw the patient that he performed a urine drug screen. My concerns with this particular case was that Dr. Rodarte used an electronic medical record that auto-filled a complete review of systems and a complete physical exam at each and every visit. No urine drug screen was performed at all until the very last visit on December 23, 2019. Had Dr. Rodarte performed a urine drug screen earlier, he may have discovered that the patient was also on methadone. An annual physical exam did not include a rectal or genital exam, no previous medical records from other physicians prior to Dr. Rodarte starting him on medications were requested for review, and no controlled substance agreement was ever documented. Due to the serious nature of this complaint, we felt a chart review was necessary. we queried the CSPMP, and we looked at 9 more patients, making this a total of 10. The concerns that I had with the other patients was, again, during the time the patient was seen, after August of 2020, Dr. Ridardi used an electronic medical record that auto-filled a complete review of systems and a normal physical exam for each visit. And that was true for all except one patient. No genital or rectal exam was performed during the entire 2 years the patient was seen, and that was true for KM and JA. The patient was only seen by telemedicine after April of 2020, and that was true for patient LW. Urine drug screens were inconsistent on multiple occasions, yet Dr. Ridardi continued to prescribe oxycodone number 120 every month, and that was true for 3 patients. Urine drug screens were documented to be performed multiple times, but the result was not included in the medical record. That was true for patient CH. A urine drug screen was performed only on the first visit and none thereafter, and that was true for patient SBV. A urine drug screen was only performed one time, and that was on the last office visit, and that was true for patient KM, the patient with involved in the complaint. It appears the patient overdosed in January of 2022, but Dr. Ridardi was not aware of this until March of 2022 and continued to prescribe opioids during that time frame, and that was true for patient JA. No previous medical records were available for review, and that was true for all of the patients. No controlled substance agreement was documented. That was true for all of the patients. There is no evidence the patient ever followed up with any referrals given by Dr. Ridardi, and that was true for patient JA. An opioid and benzo were prescribed concomitantly. There was no discussion in the medical record regarding the dangers of the use of an opioid and benzo being prescribed concomitantly, and that was true for patient LW. The actual harm identified was that patient KM overdosed on the same day that he was prescribed Xanax by Dr. Ridardi. And an aggravating factor was that he had also been prescribed benzos by another provider earlier, as well as he was prescribed methadone from a clinic. So, of course, that wasn't evident in the CSPMP because that is not documented in the CSPMP. But again, had Dr. Ridardi done urine drug screens, he would have been able to realize that. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Prada. That was an excellent summary. Dr. Duarte, do you want to speak and kind of respond to these allegations? Because they're really quite extreme, in my opinion. So I think there's a total misdirection here about writing opioids and benzodiazepines. So, or Mr. Carey, would you like to comment, or do you want to wait till after we're finished?
Well, I can comment briefly, Dr. Stosser, and then certainly we would have Dr. Ridarte make some statements, if that's okay.
back due to technical difficulties. It's all getting better. All right, Mr. Carey, the last time I talked to you, I asked you, do you want to wait to summarize, or do you want to wait till Dr. Wardarte comments on these, on this case?
You know, normally my practice is to wait, but for this one, because Dr. Frog provided a bulleted list, I thought it would be helpful to kind of frame a few items for you, which might help with the discussion. One of the things that Dr. Frog mentioned is there's a blind spot in the CSPMP, and this is actually something that I learned through this process, that apparently if you are in a treatment facility and you are being dispensed methadone, there is no requirement that the methadone be put on the CSPMP. And I think this was a case where there's sort of a perfect storm in that this was someone who came to Dr. Wardarte not seeking Xanax, not seeking opioids, and this wasn't an opioid case, but he wasn't engaged in what was typically the drug-seeking behaviors that we often see. He filled out all of his paperwork, listing the medications that he was on, but leaving off methadone, not endorsing any substance use whatsoever, and then continue to return, which is also somewhat inconsistent for what I would consider to be drug-seeking behavior. In fact, Dr. Wardarte started him on clonazepam, not on alprazolam. He sought routine medical care, including physicals, and so there wasn't an indication from the presentation of this patient that he was someone who had the substance history that he did. In fact, he at the beginning said he didn't have insurance and didn't disclose prior clinicians either. And it was a relatively young guy, so that's not out of the realm of possibility. I think what's important here is the minute, for the board to consider, is the minute this patient started throwing up red flags, which was he picked up a prescription for alprazolam from another provider, which is one of the bases for when you need to investigate further. The way Dr. Wardarte responded is he counseled the patient, indicated that he has to use sole source, and on top of that, he also then started arranging for a urine drug screening. And so I do think that there's some evidence here that when something went, appeared that there was a red flag, he did respond to it. I was troubled, and obviously I know we're focused today on Dr. Wardarte, but I was somewhat troubled that the care home appeared to have awareness that Dr. Wardarte was involved in the treatment of this individual to the point that the patient told them that he was going back to his PCP for Xanax, and they never reached out. In fact, the first time we were aware that this care home was out there is when they filed the complaint. And so it's very problematic, I think, that they have a care home who has essentially superior knowledge of that they are providing methadone, a substance that could interact, and they're not letting the PCP know. And so that, I thought, was a mitigating factor here as opposed to aggravating. In turning to the other individuals, I would note that we had Dr. Julian Grove look at all the charts. He is a dual-boarded anesthesiologist and pain management doctor, the former president of the Pain Association for Arizona, and someone who consults frequently in the community for pain management. And overall, he did find adherence to the standard of care. One of the things that he noted was that anytime a patient presented with something that could be a red flag, medication that should be there that wasn't, THC, the overdose issue, Dr. Wardarte pivoted and changed the way he treated that person. There was an individual whose benzos were not showing up when oxy was not showing up when it should have. He brought the person in. He started engaging in more intensive urine drug screens and overall adjusted his approach consistent with what a pain management contract would require. The other thing I would note is that for some of these individuals, for instance, the individual he saw for telehealth, it was an elderly patient who, when the telehealth visit started, it was right after COVID began when there were no vaccinations available. So we had an elderly person who was essentially in a position where there were concerns about her safety, and telehealth made sense. I also looked through about 4 years of his PMPs, and he is below 90, or he does not exceed 90 MME for almost his entire patient chart, except for two patients. One was in a horrific accident and would be qualified as an intractable pain patient now under the new statute. And the other one was not a significant long-term patient. So this is not someone, and we've all been in these cases where someone is, you know, 200, 300, 400 MME. This was his entire patient load, except for two patients, was below 90.
Or 90 or below. Also, I do want to emphasize the fact that regarding the current practice, we provided you his recent cohort of 2,900 providers. He has written essentially almost no opioids. He's written, right now, he's not writing anything which has benzos and opioids together. Not a single instance of the Holy Trinity. There's absolutely nothing here in his current dosing or prescribing that would be problematic. He's a very low prescriber. And then finally, you know, I want to emphasize that he's taken 44 hours of prescribing education and record keeping education. He went to PACE and did the most intensive courses that are available on his own, and he was successful on both of those. You know, in closing, the concern I have about using KM as our lodestar about how Dr. Rodarte practices is that this was someone who came in deceiving both his care home and Dr. Rodarte, both on his paperwork, in his interactions. And also, I don't know if he knew about this, but, you know, there is that gap in the CSPMP. And so I think overall, I think this is, it is understandable how we are in this situation. What I would ask the board to do is speak in some detail to Dr. Rodarte, both about anything he wants to talk about with these allegations, but also about the changes he's made in his practice, which are backed up by the PMP. I mean, they're supported by the PMP. In addition, Dr. Grove's report goes patient by patient and explains the standard of care, the prescribing decisions were made, and the fact that he keyed into every time there was a red flag, Dr. Rodarte did make a reasoned and educated decision to modify the practice. And that is very different than I think a lot of the pain management cases that you see where a doctor is essentially just on autopilot. If the patient asks for more oxy, they give them more oxy. If they say, my back hurts, they start giving them oxy above 90 MME. That is not this case. And overall, he has been consistent in his prescribing. In fact, titrating people down, and now he's essentially out of the opioid prescribing and Xanax prescribing at a much lower level. So we would ask for consideration on those items. I hope this is helpful to frame the issues. Certainly, please ask whatever you think is appropriate of Dr. Rodarte.
Thank you, Mr. Carey. I do have, and I think there were some statute violations. What he did or doing currently, I applaud him for that. It's important that he restricts his writing of these substances because it was overdone. There's been, when I'm reviewing this case, there's a lot of diversion that he missed. I mean, the patient was definitely manipulating him, and he just went on continuing to write the prescriptions, which I find, I'll just give you a case in hand. But the first time he came in, all right, there wasn't a UDS that was performed. And right off the bat, Dr. Duarte prescribed a benzodiazepine. Now, why would you do that without checking, first of all, the PMP site and getting a urine drug screen? Just like Dr. Pross said, probably was on methadone at that time as well through a clinic. That would have stopped this whole mess. So,
that's true.
So, Dr. Duarte, you want to comment on that?
The patient during the whole course of therapy never indicated to us that he was taking methadone or that he was in any detox clinics in the past. The detox clinics were aware first that this patient was taking methadone combined with the benzo.
Also, at the same time, they were failing to collect urine drug analysis at the same time. At my, in my side, my clinic, I was not, the patient didn't raise any red flags. He was never informed, and he actually liked me, that he was not receiving any extra care from other facilities. And that's why also we never obtained any records. And we always check the PMP. PMP has flaws, in my opinion. I mean, I think the system doesn't show the methadone use because it's been dispensed, not prescribed. But at the same time, this could have been prevented in a certain degree in the clinic, the physician at the detox clinic would call me and let me know about the fact that he was taking methadone.
Okay, so I have one more. Oh, you want to comment, Barb, or can I just say something real quick? I want to say something here about the version, all right? March 8th of 2019, patient noted Xanax was weaning off and he wanted to increase the frequency. Dr. Rodarte continued the Xanax 1 milligram number 30. On April 5th, the patient again requested Xanax to be increased frequency. Dr. Rodarte continued the medication one time per day. On May 3rd, 2019, the patient again requested Xanax to be increased. Now your patient is telling that he wants to increase his usage. Dr. Rodarte, in his wisdom, continued the medication at one per day and advised to see a psychiatrist. Okay, so did you make a referral to a psychiatrist? All right?
Yes, sir.
Not sure. You did?
I did refer the patient to a psychiatrist.
Okay, very good. On June 3rd of 2019, the patient noted that he could not afford to see a psychiatrist. That's a red flag there, doctor. And asked to increase his Xanax frequency. Dr. Rodarte increased his Xanax now to 1 milligram twice a day. On July 3rd, the patient returned to the office for refills. Xanax 1 milligram BID, number 6, it was prescribed. On July 29th, the patient returned to the office noting that Xanax BID was not helping. And he actually was taking it 3 times a day, doctor. Dr. Rodarte added clonazepam. Did you add clonazepam to the alprazolam medication as well, so you have 2 benzodiazepines?
I don't remember ever giving 2 benzodiazepines to any patient. I never do that. Maybe if he was added, it probably had to be offered from the other bands before we start the medication. The only
problem, I don't know if there's a good excuse for that, doctor. I just think that there's been so much diversion here, and this patient was manipulating you, and you didn't get it. You just didn't get it. You just kept on writing the prescriptions. All right. I have a couple other comments. You were noted to say that you prescribed the Xanax so he can to help him to wean off. Really? You're going to help the benzo-addicted person to wean off himself? That's never going to happen, doctor. Never. December 13, doctor noted that he discussed with the patient on the ED visit, his hospitalization, and patient denied seen in the ED or admitted to the drug abuse. And if you talked to him about the ED visit, you must have known that he was in the emergency room. Is that correct, doctor?
He never disclosed that he was in the emergency room.
You said, doctor, well, I don't know. Did you discuss with the patient regarding the ER visit on November 12th of 2019?
And he lied to you.
I know the patient was very deceiving.
Well, you should have picked up on that, doctor. You shouldn't be prescribing this kind of medication. All right? You should know better.
That's what we send them
the to. And for that day, the only UTS that was done was positive for methadone. And this whole time, he was on methadone, most likely, and receiving Xanax. I mean, that's just ridiculous. So I'm going to open the questions to the board if they would like to comment on this case, but I find it kind of egregious personally.
Dr. Strasser, before you go too far, we didn't give the Dr. Rudonte a chance for open comment, just to respond. Did he want to comment to Dr. Rudonte's presentation?
What he said.
I just...
So, Mr. Carey, you went out of your normal order. I just want to make sure there was nothing else Dr. Rudarte wanted to add besides your initial comment before we proceed.
Well, I think Dr. Rudarte can respond to some of the concerns by Dr. Erbstasser, if that's permitted, Dr. Matem.
That's fine.
And do you want to talk a little bit about the treatment of this patient?
Well, the red flag that the first was raised by KM patient was the fact that he went to get another prescription for another physician based on the PMP. And the patient was, this issue was confronted to the patient and advised to be seen by a psychiatrist. Patient didn't have insurance and apparently cannot afford financially the referral. But the attempt to taper the dosages were done by me in order to bring him off and take him off from the medication.
Well, that never happened, right? He never got weaned off the medication. In fact, he overdosed.
This was an overdose that he was done intentionally by the patient, yes. It was caused by the patient. The patient never demonstrated any suicidal attempt or ideation from the previous history of the patient and any of the visits.
And I might be wrong, Dr. Obsessor, but I did not see the dual prescribing, and maybe that my quality of this is not good, but I saw that the alprazolam was prescribed on 7/3, I think it was, and then on 7/20, the clonazepam was prescribed, and then the alprazolam was resumed in late August. So I didn't see the duplication of the benzos that were noted. I think there was I don't see that they were simultaneously prescribed. I see every month a benzo, but I don't see the duplication on the PMP that's noted by the chair.
All right, I would like Dr. Prahl, maybe you comment on what you wanted to say, please.
Well, I just did not want to lose sight of the like you discussed, the main issue here was that, in my estimation, no methadone clinic calls a primary care physician to tell them that the patient's on methadone. They're federally funded, and they're not ever required to submit that to the CSPMP. And the reason that you do urine drug screens is so that you know that the patient's on methadone. It's the only way to know. And unless the patient's honest and tells you, but you can see that that doesn't happen very often. If the patient's diverting or abusing, they're not going to tell you that they're also on methadone. And that's your job to find that out. And that's why, and you failed to do urine drug screens on this man. And then, you know, you didn't get any kind of documentation about who he had seen prior to you, because he came to you for refills. And also, you did not have controlled substance agreements with any of these people. I mean, you did, you know, we're talking about not what you're doing today, we're talking about these things that happened in the past. I'm glad that you have corrected some of the issues, but I'm just saying that this speaks for itself.
And I would note that there is a controlled substance agreement for this patient. It's unsigned, but it is in his chart. And so, this isn't a situation where he doesn't use them. there is a controlled substance agreement in the chart, and I think Dr. Rodarte can address that if you'd like as well.
Mr. Carey, you're an attorney. What good is a contract that's not signed?
Well, it's not. First of all, I don't want to necessarily testify, Chair, but a controlled substance contract is not really a contract necessarily. It is essentially a informed consent, just documentation of the way in which the relationship will go between the provider and the patient. I think what is important is if it's in his chart, we assume he received a copy of it, but also every time there was an issue that arose that was sufficient to cause a concern with these patients, he did take steps. This isn't someone who, I understand this patient.
Excuse me, back to my question though. The reason we have people sign those is so that we don't have to just believe that they're provided the information, but that we know they're provided the information. He could just throw anything in the chart if he's not going to get it signed.
I don't think it's fair to say that he didn't make it available to them or that it would be in the chart if it wasn't given to them. I certainly understand your concern. I think what I was speaking to more is in practice when you saw him with these patients in the chart review, he was taking steps when things were not as they should have been with these patients' behaviors as to their medications. You did not see significant escalation of medication. You didn't see him not testing these folks. There are urine drug screens throughout the charts that show that when there was a concern or an issue, he did take steps, including with this patient, who when he started to throw up red flags by going to two prescribers. So I understand the concern, certainly. I also don't necessarily know that the standard of care for Xanax prescribing requires a controlled substance or pain management contract. It's certainly a very good practice, but there are, I don't know that you can establish that the standard of care for Xanax by itself is a contract, because that's just not the state of practice, unfortunately, with providers. There's very few that actually sign on Xanax a controlled substance agreement.
So when I was a drug addict, I signed my contract because I thought I had to, and I was informed that I had to be able to receive medication. So I don't know. I'd like to hear from the other providers here, but do you not care to get your informed consent signed?
Yes, we do care.
Yes, and something I'm aggressive with, be it opioid, benzodiazepine. So yes.
And I don't want to, just overlook what you're saying, Mr. Carey. Absolutely, right? You're trying to paint a picture of all the good that he's doing, and we're trying to evaluate the whole picture, and we weigh those things, right? So, yeah, he did some things well, but also did a lot of bad things. And it's not those individual instances, but it's the whole picture that we're looking at here of, it's already been said several times, but, man, of course he didn't tell you those things, because he's getting drugs and he's smart. He's not an idiot. He knows if he tells you what you want to hear, you're going to keep giving it to him. That's how it works. A dumb person goes and tells you the truth about it. That's the type of behavior you should be looking for. It's not the obvious red flags. It's the subtle red flags that you should really be caring about.
And I don't want to, obviously, I want Dr. Rodarte to have some opportunities to respond. I think one of the concerns I have is I don't think there's an establishment that with the prescription merely of Xanax for someone who has nothing on their CSPMP, there's necessarily a standard of care that requires, that compels urine drug screening. It is certainly a best practice. It is certainly something that should be done. But that's even the black box warning on Xanax does not contain anything regarding any kind of the cautions in the same way that require the urine drug, any kind of urine drug screening. It is a best practice, and I understand what's said, and I think it's important that we draw the distinction there. I mean, this is someone who did lie, and then as to Dr. Pra's comment, I respect that. The methadone is not showing up in the PMP, but we also do have a clinic who knows what's going on and just does not take any steps to intervene either, and I think that is mitigating. I certainly would want Dr. Rodarte to be able to respond to, you know, some of this, because I think it's important that he talk about what his observations were and his participation was and why he made the care decisions he did. So if I can have him respond, that might help.
Yeah, absolutely. And just one more question to add to that response then is, what sort of symptoms does someone have that you prescribe them Xanny bars right out the gate? You know, a Xanny bar is the whole bar, right? You're given this 1 milligram thing, it's this whole bar. People abusing it would love that kind of access right away. So what did he present with that qualified him to receive that medication?
Well, the patient was prescribed Xanax to control his intractable anxiety. He had severe anxiety. The patient was really agitated when he was at the office every time that he was seen at the office. And the other issue that...
Did you do a scale from visit to visit? Did you test that?
Scale of what?
Did you measure the anxiety from visit to visit and keep a scale of his progress?
Not at that point in those years we weren't doing that. Now we're doing it. I don't think there were back then those requirements are available on those scales that we have now. And the other issue that I want to bring up is that this was not an accidental overdose. This patient actually intended to overdose. And he took multiple tablets, along with the fact that he was taking the methadone. And he was not the better interaction between the two drugs that actually caused the overdose. It was the excessive amount of tablets that he intentionally did.
Dr. Rodarte, when someone is actively involved in drug abuse and a drug addict, that is one of the factors that leads them to want to overdose. So getting to that point with the drug addiction and having the access to the drugs that allows him to get to that stage where he wants to is part of the problem. We can't just say because he did it himself, it's not our fault.
I perfectly understand your concern, but this patient never disclosed in the C12 the fact that he was having issues on the past of drug addiction. He never mentioned it in his history, and we were not aware of it.
Did you ask him when he first came in? You do a review of systems, right? You go to past medical history and past surgical history, right?
Yes.
He's been based on our records, he's been in rehabilitation 5 times since the age of 15. Wouldn't that be a red flag if you were able to pull it out of him? Major depressive disorder, generalized anxiety disorder, alcohol use disorder, opiate use disorder. Did you even know about this before you started prescribing these medications? Did you ask the questions? Do we have documentation?
Yes, sir. We took the history on the patient, and he never disclosed the fact that he was in previous detox clinics for drug abuse or alcohol.
Okay, so then you would agree that a urine drug screen would have been very beneficial that first visit. Correct?
Since he never disclosed the fact, he didn't indicate the fact that he was a problematic patient.
Doctor, you prescribe Xanax. You should do a urine drug screen before.
We definitely now, I understand your concern about this, and we made a lot of changes, and now we're doing those cases that we now do. But back then, he didn't indicate the fact that we needed to do the drug screen on a low-dose Xanax patient that we were seeing every 30 days. He didn't raise any red flags at the beginning of his visits.
Dr. Bergstrom, may I?
Oh, yes.
I'm just very concerned that even after all of the education that you've been through at PACE, that you still are insisting that there was no way for you to know that this because the patient didn't tell you when he first came in. If you would have gotten old medical records from his previous physician, you may have been able to find out that he had been in rehab 5 times since the age of 15. If you would have gotten a urine drug screen, you may have been able to find out he was already on methadone. I mean, I just don't understand why you're still trying to defend the fact that you didn't know these things, and you're saying that he should have told you. Of course he wasn't going to tell you. He was there to get Xanax.
You can answer that. I think Dr. Pras asking, and if you need to move up to hear a little better, but Dr. Pras asking you, with the classes now, do you have insight about this case?
Definitely, I have a lot of insight. I mean, these classes, these courses of prescriptions, prescribing opiates on controlled substances, they're eye-opening now. And highly beneficial, I think, to any provider that's prescribing this type of drugs. I mean, this case happened, 4 or 5 years ago? A lot of changes have been made. And corrections about, you know, changing. I think we evolved through the process of practicing medicine. And we find errors that we might have done in the past, we definitely correct them. My priority is not to damage a patient. I really protect my patients to any issues regarding my therapies to them.
And if I may, I think the place we're falling short here, and I think I want to make sure we communicate effectively, is can you explain what you would have done differently in this case? Because I think that's a lot of people are asking that question, and I don't know I think that's what they need to be able to hear from you, is with retrospect, what would you have done differently in this case?
Well, now I would definitely all patients now that they require a controlled substance, they do a UDS, a drug analysis or toxicology if indicated, before the starting of the prescriptions. I'm seeing every month for the prescriptions still. Every 30 days, I've been accustomed to that. To any patient with controlled substance, we see them every 30 days. We try to now offer non-opioid or non-controlled substances treatments, multiple referrals, multiple workups. And of course, we see the PMP in every 30 days and review it and discuss it with the patient if there's any deviations. Many, many things have done now differently than we did 5 years ago, of course.
If I may, just to be clear, that the standard of care as far as surveillance and care study 4 or 5 years ago, that was COVID. The articles that were starting to support the fact that we were practicing medicine wrong started 20 years ago. This is not a new problem, and this did not start 4 or 5 years ago. Well within this 2019 prescribing practice, this was already a known problem. And it had been well addressed. I do have a couple of questions, if I may. Dr. Strasser.
Go ahead.
Dr. Prad, did you have any evidence of that intensive UDS monitoring that Mr. Carey had mentioned? I did not see much UDS monitoring, but Mr. Carey mentioned there was intensive monitoring of the UDSs.
I would have to go back and look at each individual case specifically.
I recall there was a severe lack of, and I did not see adequate addressing of the discrepancies on UDSs. Dr. Rodarte, can you point out where you did intensive UDS monitoring or charted adequately that you addressed the inconsistent UDS flow? I did not find that.
It's hard to understand the, I cannot hear your question very well on the echo that is in the system. Can you repeat the question?
Absolutely, not a problem. So can you point out to me on the charts provided where you did intensive EDS monitoring and where, if at all, that you addressed to the patient when there was an inconsistency with the urine drug screen that you addressed to the patient the violation?
Yeah, well, we definitely were raising the issues to the patient when there were inconsistencies in the urine drug analysis, so whether it needed to be repeated several times, having the patient return weekly or even discontinue the medication or give referrals to pain management or psychiatry if necessary.
I'm sorry, Mr. Carey, could you help him?
Yeah, he's looking for if you feel like you adequately charted the intervention with the client or the patient when you had these inconsistencies.
Yes, we did charting on the inconsistencies of the findings from the drug analysis. We did.
Did you find when you charted adequately was addressed with inconsistencies?
No. I can point out in my concerns about the chart review is that in about urine drug screens, in that there were three patients in which he was prescribing oxycodone number 120 every month, and the urine drug screens were inconsistent on multiple occasions, yet he continued to prescribe. And then there was another case, patient CH, where urine drug screens were documented to be performed multiple times, but the result was not included in the medical record. And then there was another case of patient SVB, in which a urine drug screen was only performed one time. And also with KM, or the case that the patient did it. Patient of the case is about KM. You only performed one time. So in the 10 patients that I looked at, I did not see that urine drug screens were being used effectively.
Thank you. Mr. Carey or Dr. Bontarte, do you have any other information in front of this charts that I missed?
We're getting a lot of feedback. We weren't able to hear that part. Could you repeat, please?
Mr. Carey or Dr. Rodarte, can you show me on these charts perhaps an area that I missed where you did address these inconsistent urine drug screens and the intensive monitoring of urine drug screens?
We can definitely do that. I don't know it's something that I can pull up. There are the files about 1,700 pages, so we can pull it up. I mean, we can go and look through the chart and provide you some further information. I don't know that I can do it while we're on the fly here. That's the only concern. I think what we were speaking to, Dr. Matem, was the fact that in this case, when he did get inconsistent results, he did his position is he did follow up with these patients. This is a situation where he did have follow-up with the patients when there were inconsistent chart or inconsistent issues or red flags. Evidence in KM when he did the urine drug screen, and then also in the instances of some of the other patients, including HA, when she tested positive for THC, he did do follow-up. He put the patient on baclofen as a non-scheduled, non-addictive skeletal muscle relaxer, and brought her back a week later for follow-up testing. So that was in 2021 for patient HA. There was a THC positive, and so he did switch to baclofen and brought the patient back within a week. So that was there. I think your point is well taken that could have been documented as to why he was doing that. But it is... that was one of the examples, Dr. Matem, that I was referring to, is that when that patient came back for THC, that was a concern. There was also, for patient CH, when the person came back for inconsistent drug screens, he does have a recollection that there was an issue here, that the person was not testing positive as she should have, and it looks like there were additional UDSs that came out of that.
Would you like me to address that?
Go ahead, Dr. Pratt. Thank you. And thank you, Mr. Carey. That helps a little bit.
In terms of patient HA, if you brought her up specifically. On March 19th, 2021, a urine drug stream was positive for alcohol but negative for the oxycodone that she had been prescribed every month. He continued the oxycodone number 120 every month. On April 15th, 2021, it was positive for THC, and he noted he would repeat it in 1 week. On April 22nd, 2021, it was negative for all medications, including oxycodone. He continued to prescribe the oxycodone. On August 21st, 2020, a urine drug stream was negative for all medications he continued to prescribe. On September 21st, 2021, a urine drug stream was positive for oxycodone and alcohol. On March 17th, 2022, urine drug stream was negative for all medications. He continued to prescribe oxycodone during this whole time. Finally, in June of 2022, he referred her to a pain management specialist. So I disagree that he did something positive when the urine drug screens were inconsistent.
Thank you, Dr. Pratt. So my question to the rest of the board is, obviously there are violations to 3218.54, chapter 6, engaging in practice in a manner that is below the standard of care, as evidenced by this discussion. Chapter 21, failing to establish and maintain records as this. And chapter 39, as far as dangerous patient or public health issue in this case, of course. So my question to the board is this a low enough concern with mitigating factors, as it sounds like the doctor has already admitted to having a problem, as evidenced by his evaluation? Or is there a continued concern that there's a lack of understanding that we need to do something with practice restriction?
Thank you, Dr. Maydam. I'd like to go into executive session for legal advice. We'll come back and entertain that colorful question. Second. Second by Dr. Maydam. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Okay. We'll be back in about 10 minutes.
All right, we can hear you now. And if it's appropriate, obviously I don't want to speak out of turn, but I have a thought before any vote is made that might be a way to thread the needle here to address the board's concerns.
Board members, are you okay with that?
That's fine with me.
Okay. Go ahead, Mr. Carey.
Here's what I heard, and if I'm stating this correctly, I want to be corrected, but it sounds like you obviously have some concerns about what happened in this case, and what you're concerned about is, well, what do we do going forward? How do we determine compliance? And here's what I would suggest as a way to thread this needle. If your thought is anything regarding a restriction, rather than impose that now, what I would suggest is, because there has been statements by Dr. Rodarte that he has made significant changes, direct Dr. Prah to again subpoena within the last 6 months some charts that still have controlled substance activity to determine if there has been an internalization of the lessons here. And also, obviously, anything that's a current patient. That way you can get sort of a new snapshot to determine if there have been changes. Because I think that's going to be the quickest and most efficient way for you to make a determination if the lessons have been learned. And I think that in the shuffle here, some things may have gotten lost about what he has learned. Because I think he was quite focused on responding to the concerns about the specific patient. But I thought this would be an interim way for the board to get a real determination of where we stand before imposing obviously something like a practice restriction that could be very detrimental to his ability to continue to practice realistically.
Thank you. All right. Do I have a motion? Input?
If I may, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Curry, I appreciate your input on that. And part of my concern is the answers to some of the questions asked are answered by Dr. Rodarte. So I think we just need to move a little bit further. So I would like to, as previously stated, cite ARS 32-1854, Chapter 6, Practice of Medicine Below the Standard of Care, 1854, Chapter 21, maintaining medical records adequately, and 1854, Chapter 39, conduct that is dangerous. My motion is for an interim order for a base evaluation for prescribing practices and for charting. That is my motion.
We have a motion on the floor and second by Mr. Goodman. All right, we need a roll call vote, please.
Dr. Oda?
Yes.
Dr. Walker?
Yes.
Mr. Berg is absent. Mr. Goodman?
Aye.
Dr. Shippum?
Yes.
Dr. Maida?
Aye.
Dr. Obstosa?
Yes. Motion passes. Any questions, Mr. Carey?
Pace right now for what you're suggesting is out a period of time, and Justin may know this. What's the when you do an interim order on these? Is there a time limit that you set for having it completed? Just I'm being mindful of Pace's schedule right now.
If it's okay with you on my motion, if you could contact Justin, because I'm not aware as far as the backlog, and
okay.
Justin can get back to us as far as the time frame, because you're correct, Mr. Carey, that is a good question.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Bohol, can you give us that answer now, or should we contact you?
I do actually have that information.
Oh,
please. We typically provide them 30 days to schedule the evaluation, and they have 6 months to complete it after that. They can always, if they're unable to schedule it within that 6 months, they can always come back and request an extension, and we have done that in the past.
Great.
Mr. Bohol, Dr. Prah,
At this time, because you have issued an interim order, any type of information that along those lines that you would be seeking would be more appropriate when the matter is finally adjudicated.
That's fine. Thank you.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Dorothy, Mr. Carey.
Thank you.
All right, let's move on to the next case. unless you'd like to have lunch or break or anything.
We're all good.
Okay. Keep going. Okay. Let's move on to 5C, GO-22-0074A. Dr. Donald, this is a Prushman. I hope that's correct. And also item D, DO-22-0057A, Dr. Donald Prushman. Do you want to take these cases together or separately?
Does that work together, Dr.
They're a little different. Why don't we handle them separate? That's okay with
you, Dr. Yeah, we just handle them separate. I just wanted to see if we could make it. It's okay. All right. Dr. Fruitman, are you available? Can I see you?
I am available. Can you see me and hear me?
Yes, okay. I can hear you.
Thank you.
Excuse me. I can hear you. Thank you very much. Okay. Do you have any legal representation?
I do not. I had legal representation through the beginning of January, and there were letters of correspondence from the attorneys answering many of the questions that were presented by Dr. Pra, going through the accusations. I received from the attorneys a notification that they wanted me to get a PACE evaluation. I think it was based on the fact that 10 years ago, I did have a problem. I went through complete evaluation, was able to change the censure on my license. And this time, I have been in practice for 57 years. I graduated PCOM in 1966. I took an internship following that and then ended up serving 2 years in the military. I was awarded or certified by the AOA as one of those individuals who broke a barrier. We became the first DOs to serve in the military as physicians. It was a very important step for osteopathic physicians. At this time, I have decided, after 57 years in practice, that I would retire from practice. And I did so as of March the 31st, 2023. I notified Optum, who I was then working for, that I was retiring from my practice. And at this time, I have been retired for almost 2 months. I understand that these charges that were brought all started with a letter from a disgruntled father about a young lady, 35 years old, who turned out to be an alcoholic, which I was not aware of, and nobody ever talked to me about it.
We're going to keep moving on with the case. I really appreciate you giving us an update on what you're doing. That was going to be my next question. We're going to have to swear you in.
Okay, that's fine.
Okay.
Dr. Bruckman, you please raise your right hand.
I will.
Thank you. And we got a good idea of your training and your
Do you swear under penalty of perjury to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Okay, thank you so much. All right, we got a brief summary of what you were doing and what you're currently, your past training. We appreciate that. Can I have a review of the case, please, Dr. Proff?
The first case came to us as a complaint from the Arizona Board of Pharmacy. The pharmacy board notified our board that Dr. Bergman had failed to query the CSPP when prescribing controlled substances during the time frame from February 2022 until April 2022. He had prescribed a total of 328 prescriptions. He did prescribe greater than 90 MMEs to 31 patients and prescribed more than 5 days' supply of opioids to 17 opioid naive patients. In Dr. Frickman's word response to his attorney, they state Dr. Frickman failed to query the CSPMP during this time frame for the patients for whom he prescribed controlled substances. They state he is now worked closely with his staff to resolve this deficiency in his practice.
Thank you, Dr. Kahn.
Do you wish for me to respond to that?
No, I'm going to respond. Do we have the complaint in here?
That was the Board of Pharmacy.
Oh, thank you. All right, we're here. All right, thank you, Dr. Craw. You want to comment, Dr. Fruchtman?
I would certainly like to comment.
Okay.
My office does Arizona PMP evaluations by a designee. In other words, an MA who is assigned to do a printout on every patient that is on a controlled substance. As it turned out, and this is why, as my lawyer stated, I accepted blame for that three-month period, because they had just assigned an MA who was brand new and apparently did not understand what they were supposed to be doing, and during that time did not do the printouts. I believe Dr. Prabh will agree that in the charts, up until that period of time, there were printouts of the Arizona PMP. As far as the drugs that were prescribed, I have been one of the few doctors in my office, there are two of us, that are the only ones that do controlled substances. We had five doctors in the practice. Three of the doctors left in the prior 6 months. So, the other doctor and myself were assigned multiple cases of patients that were on drugs like Adderall, benzos, and narcotics. Because of this, there were many more scripts written that shouldn't probably have been written as easily, but we had to cover our patients. Many of these patients were sent to pain management, but as it turns out, in Arizona, pain management is not always available immediately. As a matter of fact, in the state of Arizona, many of the pain management doctors will not give a script to a patient, despite a referral, for up to 2 months after they receive the referral. So in many of these cases, and let me follow that up by saying, the other doctor and myself did make a decision, and I think the lawyer did put this in his letter, that we had decided that any opioid scripts were going to be stopped as of the beginning of January 2023. We were not going to be supplying any opioids to any of these patients. So that was one way of trying to improve the amount of scripts that were being written. As far as RXing benzos or Adderall, we did continue to do that, but we also continued to monitor these people. And we used the Arizona PMP on a consistent basis and did a printout on these people. But we did refer them out. As I said, there were only two of us that were now doing the load of five doctors. I'm not using that as an excuse, but that's what happened. And as far as the three-month period, I'm accepting blame for that. I understand. I should have been more on top of it when this new MA did not do the printouts, especially since I was the one writing these scripts. So I agree with what Dr. Pross said in this situation. That's basically what I want to state about this particular situation.
Thank you. I'm going to open the questions to the board members.
Yes.
Any questions, concerns? Well, let me ask you, Dr. Can you say your last name for me? I want to make
sure. It's Brookman. Yes,
Brookman.
It's almost like a Brook or with an F.
Okay, Brookman. Okay, yes. Thank you. So you have since retired, correct?
I certainly did, yes.
Okay, are you going to maintain your license?
Well, that's the reason I wanted to put myself in front of the board. I was hoping that I could. For this reason, I do not wish to be a physician prescribing any controlled drugs. But I perform osteopathic manipulation in my office. I volunteer to do physicals at schools. I may want to teach. I have propensity to do some other things. And for that reason, I would like to retain my license so that I'm able to do those things. I do not plan to be renewing any controlled drug license because I don't feel that I want to be doing that anymore. That was actually one of the reasons that I decided to retire. It has become very difficult in family practice to use controlled substances of any kind because it's not always easy to refer patients out. If it was, it would make our job much easier. But that is not the case in our present environment.
Thank you. Dr. Maida?
Mr. Bohol, is that something that we can do in physicians voluntarily not prescribe controlled substances?
You can offer a practice restriction that would specify that you would not be prescribing any of the scheduled class drugs.
Can I do that without discipline?
Not without discipline. It would have to be a consent agreement to resolve the case.
So stating violations 32.18.54.6 and engaging in a practice below the manner of care, 39, any contact to Ogartis that endangers the public health, and 34, failure to or inappropriate direction of medical staff, I do find a violation. I would like to make a motion for a practice restriction restricting that the prescription of controlled substances, but no other practice restriction in the position.
We have a motion on the floor. Do we have a second?
Second, Dr. Walker.
Second by Dr. Walker. Do we have a roll call vote?
Yes, please.
Dr. Oda?
Yes.
Dr. Walker?
Yes.
Mr. Goodman?
Aye.
Dr. Shiffon?
Yes.
Dr. Maynard?
Aye.
Dr. Ernst-Dessner?
Yes. Okay, motion passes.
Yeah. And if I may, Doctor, I really appreciate you still being out there. I appreciate you doing your medical care, manipulation, and physicals. I do not mean to insult you in any way. I really appreciate your 54 years of practice. Is that what you said?
57.
God bless your soul.
Close. 54 is close, but actually 57.
Thank you for what we've done for our community. I do appreciate that.
Okay, thank you.
Dr. Pruma, we still have a second case here that we need to adjudicate. So,
okay.
All right. And you're still sworn in. I'm just going to remind you that.
Okay, thank you.
Dr. Pruma?
The complainant in this case is the father and legal guardian of patient L.R. The complainant states that Dr. Frickman was warned by pharmacies several times regarding his dangerous prescribing to patient L.R., but he continued to prescribe 7 different drugs. He states his daughter suffers from traumatic brain injury, depression, alcoholism, and has now been diagnosed by Dr. Forsman with ADHD. He states she was prescribed oxycodone, Adderall, lorazepam, Lyricet, thyroid, sertraline, and pantoprazole. This was a 35-year-old female that Dr. Kirkman began seeing on May 21st, 2021. I'll go right to the standard of care deviations. The full medical records for this patient were not sent by Dr. Kirkman's office, so we reviewed what was sent. There were no previous medical records requested or reviewed from previous physicians. There was no controlled substance agreement. There were no urine drug screens. There were no diagnostic studies performed regarding the etiology of the patient's pain. Dr. Kirkman prescribed opioids and benzodiazepines concomitantly. He was warned by Express Scripts of concerns regarding the controlled substances he was prescribing to patient LR, yet he continued to prescribe the medications. Dr. Fruchtman continued to prescribe controlled substances even though the patient appeared to be drinking heavily during one particular telemedicine visit and then failed to follow up as directed. Thank you.
Dr. Fruchtman, would you like to comment?
Yes, I would. I am very sorry that the other records did not get to Dr. Prah. The problem and the reason she did not get them, we had gone onto a new computer system when we got taken over by Optum, our practice. So the old records, which should have been kept, apparently got lost in the shuffle. That did not help this case because had she seen those, number one, there was a contract with this patient because when I first saw her, she was placed on Adderall. At that time, she had an EKG done, which is routinely done on any patient starting Adderall, and she had a controlled drug contract and a urine done. All those were done at that time. Following that, she continued to come in on a regular basis monthly. She admitted to us that she was a party girl. She liked to drink with her friends. She never told us that she was a consistent alcoholic, someone who drank consistently and hid it, etc. Her father and mother, and her father was the one who sent in the letter of basically to the board complaining, based his complaints on these notes that come in from Express Scripts, which we in the office get on a regular basis. What they say is, do you know that you're prescribing a benzo with a narcotic? Do you know that you're prescribing Adderall with a benzo, et cetera, et cetera? And he based his feelings that I was doing wrong because of these letters. We look at these all the time. We understand those. Number one, she was on Adderall. I admit to prescribing that for her. She was followed up on a regular basis. In our particular office, we usually did every 3 months visits for people on Adderall. In addition, during COVID, many of these visits were telemedicine visits. And that was one reason why a lot of times urine drug screens didn't get done. However, she had at least 2 urine drug screens done when she was at the hospital. And both of them showed that there was alcohol in her system. So I knew at those times she was drinking. But that didn't make her an alcoholic. And nobody ever discussed it with us. As a matter of fact, the only time that I had a discussion with her father, who sent the complaint in, was he came into the office and dropped some paperwork off. He said to the receptionist, my daughter is now living on the street, and she's doing things that I'm not happy with. And he felt that I was responsible for this. At least that's what he seemed to indicate. And I didn't agree with him at all because this was ridiculous. I understood that she was drinking apparently more than I thought she was. And in fact, the last visit that I saw her was a telemedicine visit, and her speech was slurred. And for that reason, I said, you know, she probably is drinking at the same time that she's taking these prescriptions, which she had been told not to do. But we still did not know that she truthfully was an alcoholic, despite urine drug screens and despite talking to her about that. And when I talked to her father, he was the first one to indicate that he felt this was the case and he wanted her in a rehab. And he said the only way he could get her into a drug rehab is if I gave approval for him to be the sole guardian of his daughter. Now, he wanted me to sign off on this without me seeing her, without me talking to her, just based on this gentleman who dropped off these papers and didn't have the courtesy to even stay around and talk to me about it, just dropped them off, and I had to call him to find out what it was all about. And as it turned out, I refused. I did not feel comfortable signing off and giving this gentleman the right to control his daughter. I thought as far as her going into an alcohol rehab, that was fine. I had no problem with that. And I did fill out papers that placed her on disability so that she could at least be on a welfare type state and be able to cover some of the costs if she went into a rehab. Because she wasn't working at the time. The boyfriend that she was living with apparently had booted her out of his apartment, and she was in a bad way. As I said, the last time I saw her before all this took place, she sounded like she was slurring her words. So that I thought this was either from the medication she was on or due to alcohol intake. I must say that as far as the medicines that she was on, other than the Adderall, she took lorazepam PRN. She did not take it every day. And if you look at her scripts, that would be indicated because she never used like two a day for every month. Additionally, the oxycodone that she was taking was a 5-milligram tablet that she was breaking in half. And the reason she was taking it is she had been seen at Barrow Neurologic following both a cervical spine injury and a head injury. And the pain management that she was referred to there felt that that was the best drug for her to be on for headaches and neck pain. As a matter of fact, he actually wanted to do cervical spine surgery on her. She refused, did not want to have it done at that time, and was going to follow up with Farrell, which she did with the neurosurgeon. But she did not follow up with the pain management. She felt more comfortable for me giving her that script. So I explained to her how to take it. I gave her a script for Narcan, which I gave to all my patients who were on opiates, and she understood that. But alcohol was the problem. And I have to say, I was not as on top of her alcohol intake as I probably should have been, because my chart continues to say, social drinker, social drinker. I knew she was a party person who enjoyed drinking when she was with her friends. I just didn't realize that the amount of alcohol she was consuming was as much as it turned out to be. And that was basically this case.
Thank you, Dr. Brugman. Has she ever been on the street before? Does she have other problems?
Never.
Or she was homeless?
Never. As a matter of fact, if somebody would have seen her come into the office, you're talking about somebody who was dressed to the nines. She came in, made up, properly dressed, high heels. I mean, the people in the office used to make fun of her sometimes because they thought she was, you know, trying to pick up a guy or something. That's the way she dressed. That's the way she was, which was fine. I had no problem with that. But nobody would have thought that she would end up on the streets.
Thank you, Dr. Friedman. I'm going to open up for board members for questions.
That's correct. No complaint at silence.
Board members, any questions? Any motions?
Okay. No, I appreciate your words. I would certainly be concerned on any patient who I was prescribing to who showed alcohol when I was doing the evaluation. But obviously there has to be a much stronger concern when somebody shows up appearing impaired during a telemedicine evaluation. I'd be concerned if somebody showed up impaired especially during evaluation. That's abnormal behavior. So we definitely have to cite ARS 1854, engaging in practice of medicine in a manner below the community standard of care, and Chapter 39, conduct of practice that endangers patient for public health. So I would like to make a motion for administrative warning for violating those statutes.
Do we have a motion on the floor? Do I have a second?
I'll second that.
Dr. Otis seconds. Okay, can we have a roll call vote, please?
Yes, sir. Dr. Oda.
Yes.
Dr. Walker?
Yes.
Mr. Goodman?
Aye.
Dr. Shippoff?
Yes.
Dr. Matum?
Aye.
Dr. Urbisto, sir?
Aye. Okay. Dr. Footman, the motion passes. Mr. Bulwark, can you explain to him?
Yes, sir. Dr. Parkman, what the board has done in this case, they issued a disciplinary order for an administrative warning. That is the lowest level of discipline that the board can impose. There's no additional requirements. It will just be provided in a summary letter to you that will be sent out likely next week.
Okay.
You can contact myself or my office on Monday. We can answer any additional questions that you may have.
I have no other questions. I'm quite content at this point. I'm happy in a way to be retired. I'm happy to finish up with this case so I can stop worrying about it and have anxiety over it. It just so happens, and this was not the funny part, I've been retired for almost 2 months, and I happen to have broken my right hip about 3.5 weeks ago. So actually, when I talked to the board, Kelly at the board, she called me, and I was in the hospital the day she called me. I had just had a couple of screws put in my hip. So I know maybe retirement's not such a good idea if you're going to end up breaking a hip. But that's what ended up resulting from my retirement.
Oh, good luck, Doctor. Thank you for being here today.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Break or keep moving?
It's open. I'm good.
Bathroom?
I'm good. Keep it going.
Bathroom? Okay. Board says keep going, so we're going to keep going. Moving on to item 6, review and consideration and actions on applications for licensure. We'll start with 6A, DO-23-0018A, Dr. Joseph Cook. Dr. Cook here?
I believe Dr. Cook is signed in to speak.
You're muted, Dr. Cook. You're muted, Dr. Cook.
Okay, how's that sound?
Cool.
That's good. That's good, okay. Dr. Cook. We can see and hear you.
Hey, I appreciate you all sticking this out on a Saturday for me and for everybody else.
You're welcome. Okay. Whose case is this?
I will have Ms. Castro provide a summary of the case.
Thank you.
Staff received an application for licensure for Dr. Joseph Cook on December 16th of 2022. On the application, Dr. Cook disclosed that he was falsely accused of sexual assault in 2020 by a friend of his granddaughter's and charged by the state of Ohio. Dr. Cook also disclosed that the Ohio Medical Board suspended his license with a consent agreement in August of 2020 while the case was investigated. As a result of the suspension of his license, Dr. Cook disclosed that he temporarily relinquished his DBA number. Dr. Cook stated that he was acquitted of all charges in 2021 and medical license and DBA. Staff has confirmed that Dr. Cook was found not guilty of the charges by a jury on April 23, 2021, and the Ohio medical license was reinstated May 11th of 2022.
Thank you very much. Dr. Cook, you want to comment a little bit on this case, please?
Well, it's been a very difficult couple of years. As I noted, a friend of my granddaughter falsely accused me of sexual assault, and then subsequently I was charged. And because of COVID, it took quite a while to clear my name. The courts were closed for quite a while at that time. And as was mentioned, in 2021, I was found not guilty, as we knew would be the case. And then subsequently, I had my license restored by the state of Ohio and recently renewed it about 2 months ago. DEA was restored once I had my license because you could not have a DEA without an active license. And I'm also currently board certified in family practice.
Thank you very much. Just real quick, any questions to the board? You'd like to ask Dr. Cook any questions?
I would just add that there were no violations that I participated in. It's just when my license was suspended, they used a violation of not going through the medical board to have the case heard to decide whether I was innocent or guilty. My lawyer and I decided to litigate this in the courts and not in front of the medical board. And so for that, they sanctioned me and put me on a consent agreement.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. All right. I'm making a motion for unrestricted license for the state of Arizona for Dr. Cook. Do I have a second?
Second.
Second by Dr. Matem. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed none. Welcome to Arizona, Dr. Cook. Are you living here now?
Yes, we moved here actually about 2 years ago. My wife has family in Arizona, and we were actually going to be moving to Arizona, but we ended up moving a couple years earlier, obviously because of what happened. But we are enjoying it here, and I already have a couple of job opportunities that I'm looking at. I do have a diabetes fellowship, and I enjoy managing complex patient cases. So I'll be looking at either focusing on diabetes management or family practice in general. We're still trying to decide which option would be the best.
Well, congratulations and welcome to Arizona, Dr. Cook.
Again, I thank you all for your time. I know you'd rather be home on a Saturday afternoon, but I do appreciate it. And again, I'll do my best for the patients of Arizona.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Moving on to item 6B, DO-23-0061A, Dr. John Garrison, DO. Is Dr. Garrison here?
Dr. Garrison has requested a continuance to seek legal counsel, so we ask for the board to continue the case for today.
Okay. We don't need a vote on that. I'm okay with that. I know. Dodgeball. That's fine. Please.
Sure do.
What? He's not here.
I just wrote to vote for him.
Okay, that's fine.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. Take care of the license.
Have a second. If you would like to move to 7, the consent agenda.
There's one item on the consent agenda to issue a non-disciplinary letter of concern. If the board wants to discuss it, we can, but the board can take the consent agenda as presented or discuss the agenda item at a future meeting.
Motion to accept the consent agenda as written.
Second by Dr. Ripstosen. All in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Opposed? Thank you.
Thank you. And then we actually have no students today. They are on summer break, so we wish them well during their summer time. Hopefully they're taking time to rest and recuperate and get ready for fall. So we'll welcome them our next meeting. Then number 9A, which is the DEA requirement for 8 hours of one-time CME on opioid prescription. This was requested to be added to the agenda just for discussion, if any of the board members wanted information or wanted to go over it.
Yeah, information. Do we already, some of the doctors here, do we already qualify for these units? Or if not, where do we go to get them?
So the information I had is that some of the continuing education that since we require the 3 hours with each renewal cycle, that some of those credits would qualify. And it is a one-time requirement. It's not a continuous requirement. And I think it's the DEA's attempt to kind of bring up a modern awareness of the opioid crisis as well as prescribing. I believe that we have some courses that are on our website about the opioid crisis and prescribing that need qualifications, but I can definitely put together a list and maybe work with the Arizona Osteopathic Association and see if there's a list that we can recommend and put out a newsletter or something on our website.
Well, yeah, because this is due when? This is due beginning on June 27th to 23. Yes. You have to check a box on the DEA registration form. And is that the time zero when we start moving forward, getting our credits? I'm a little confused about that.
From what I understand, this is when you would renew the next time you renew it after June 27th, you would need to have
renew
this.
Renew your DEA? Is that what you mean?
Correct. Yes. Yes, mm-hmm. When you renew your DEA. And then also, I mean, and what they're saying is that they're going to count credits back to, I think, December 2022. So you can use those credits when you renew as after June 20th. There's nothing we have to do. My personal opinion on some of this is what you were saying, Justin, is people have trouble finding what qualifies and what do they need to do. And it would be a lot easier if they just had like a course that you could just register online and be like, okay, this is the one we need to do. And then we're done. But, every state seems to have different, criteria. Some carry over between states, some count for the DA, some don't. It's, I think they're making it a little confusing. So yeah, if there's links that we could provide, I think that would be really helpful to make sure everyone's in compliance.
Yeah, I want to make sure that all doctors have the access to get these credits done, and where to get them done, and do they have the criteria? I guess so. That's why I wanted it.
And then some you have to, you know, obviously some CMA obviously you have to pay for, some are free, you know, and obviously everyone wants to do the free one. So, it does make it, you know, it would be nice if they just had, you know, like an online course that you could just do and
right.
Be done.
Right. All right. Thank you, Dr. Schmarrn and Mr. Ball.
And I'm sorry, is this the one that gives credit if you've done the X waiver, or is this out of that time frame?
The
DEA
X waiver,
I'm not sure if that does include that. Maybe depends on the timeline. I would note that because the X waiver, you know, be expiring, that no longer being required, I don't know how that factors into it. That's something I can
see is attached to good education.
And that's something I can look up to make sure that that's answered.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay. Mess here. Justin?
Yep. Moving on to tab 10, number A is the report from board members, and that item is the Federation of State Medical Boards Annual Meeting 2023. And I would turn this over to you, Dr. Rixosa.
So we all went to our FSMB meeting in Minnesota, and the weather wasn't too bad. It was quite nice. There was a lot of challenges there in terms of, you know, what we're doing. But the biggest is the sexual misconduct forum that was done, as well as what we're doing with the opioid crisis. So I'm going to ask Justin to go ahead and speak just a little bit on those.
So, yes, the Federation put on a couple of really wonderful sessions on that, and I'm actually going to ensure that we get copies of the links because they're recorded. So I will want to share those with board members so that you're able to view them. We did have the President Biden's, they call him the opioid czar, but he's the person in charge of drug policy. It's the first physician that is actually in charge of the entire state's drug policy, the entire country's drug policy. And he spoke at one of the meetings. It was a fantastic piece of information regarding the opioid crisis and the ways that we need to address that, and what changes have been made, and what, from a federal policy perspective, is going to be done differently now that he's establishing this policy. There was another course that was actually very helpful from the Ohio State Medical Board, in which they provided a review of their process for sexual misconduct cases. And it was absolutely fantastic and eye-opening. In reviewing it, we're grateful that we haven't had the necessity to implement the program that they have. But learning from other agencies and other states to make improvements before we get to that situation. So I'm going to recommend that and I'm going to have staff view it as well. Some of the process improvement they've implemented, having it's called a victim advocate, and then they recommended maybe calling that something else, like a witness advocate or something like that, to help the person that's filing the complaint understand the process and make sure that they're comfortable through that process and engaging with the board so that the board has the information that they need early on. It's also, they talked about partnering specifically with their legal counsel to ensure that they have the evidence that they need either to prove the allegations or to exonerate the doctor, depending on the situation. They also implemented a quality assurance review that after they had adjudicated the case, they would go back and review it to make sure that they really had made the right decision, follow up and try to get additional information, and if needed, work with their legal counsel to reopen the case and take a different action. So that was something that was, I found very helpful, very interesting. And I'll make sure that the board members do that as well. I think that's everything that I had.
Yeah, no, I think that was really well said, Mr. Bowles. It's hard to summarize all of that. Those positions that he was talking about in Ohio, they were paid positions by the state, which I found really fascinating. From the investigators, to the research team, to the person who was helping that individual meet the requirements, going to the case, going through, you know, rehab or whatever, or being a victim. So I just found that fascinating. And this all started with a case that was in Ohio, where a doctor was at Ohio State, if I remember correctly, and was molesting students. So it was really, it's pretty bad. So anyway, thank you very much for that. All right, Doug Maynham, you want to comment on anything about what you saw and what you felt?
That was fantastic. After about 2 days, we talked about the physician health being honest about our own humanity, to try to help save physicians too and get people into treatment programs. Certainly, it's been a good pre-dawn session with the AA and everything's awesome. And exhausting of those later evenings and early mornings, along with some of the convex and other training. So it's definitely a good one.
Yeah. Thank you, Dr. Camino. So I think some of the things we talked about regarding what the Federals are doing, Dr. Gupta is, you know, he is the director. These are going to be on the FSMB website. So it would be worth looking at so you can get an idea of what's going in from the government standpoint, how much money they're putting in, which is quite a bit of money. Where are they trying to access? Where do you stock the drugs? Do they stock them when they're coming over the border? No, it starts in the country itself and the production, and you learn to choke them off, their money. And that's what they're going after, which I find very interesting. So anyhow, Justin will let everybody know at that time when they're available that you can go on the FSMB site and you can look at those lectures. So it's worthwhile doing. And I think that was about it. Oh, except...
Oh, award-winning staff.
Award-winning staff here. Okay. I mean, this is big stuff. Actually, it's really complimentary. I'm going to start with Justin. He was voted, our executive director, he was voted to the board for the western half of the United States as an executive director. So he is moving up in stature. And... we appreciate you, and we don't hope you leave us.
Not a chance.
But congratulations on that honor. I think it says a lot about our staff. And award of merit to Dr. Barbara Fraw-Wicks. And I'm going to read this to you because I could not say it as well as this. Dr. Praw has dedicated more than 20 years to her roles as a medical consultant to the Arizona Board of Osteopathic Examiners in Medicine and Surgery, leading medical investigations in more than 5,000 cases. Her passion for advocating for physicians struggling with addiction is evident in her oversight of the board's confidential monitoring program for substance use disorder. In 2021, Dr. Praw Fraw-Wicks championed an improved confidential program to ensure physicians receive the best options for rehabilitation. In addition to her work on the board, she serves as a lecturer to the osteopathic medical students, medical ethics and jurisprudence at Midwestern University and ATS Still University, and presents regularly to the schools on topics such as opiate prescribing and addiction, physician burnout, and wellness. Dr. Praw's unwavering dedication supporting physicians and advancing the medical field made her a respected leader in the Arizona medical community. So thank you, Dr. Praw. She had a little trophy, a little glass thing. So we appreciate you. All right. Where do we go, Justin? You're the boss up next, executive director.
That takes care of you. Move on to the executive director's report. Unfortunately, due to some technical issues, I did not finish my report, so I have nothing to report to you.
No problems.
Other than generically, overall, we're doing well, technical difficulties aside. staff continues to see an increase in licensing applications. I realize that I'm muted. So staff sees an increase in the number of licensing applications we receive. Of course, that process is entirely online now. And I think because we kind of removed some of the barriers on paper applications, we just continue to see that rise. And I would be very proud to let you guys know that even with an increased volume of applications, staff still tries to keep those processing times as low as possible. We're still about, on average, 30 days, maybe a little bit higher just because of volume, but the dedication to customer service that the licensing team has is truly profound. On that note, moving to investigations, we continue to process investigations as quickly as possible. Harla and Lindsay and Dr. Prod have worked very hard to ensure that we're gathering all the records that we possibly need to fairly adjudicate those cases. We've actually recently had a breakthrough in the cases that are coming from VA. Had difficulty in obtaining those records, but we finally now able to have a direct contact and someone that was more willing to provide those records. So we're hoping to see some of those VA cases be resolved soon. We are on track for our financial report through the end of the year. The new budget has been passed. We're no longer concerned about a fiscal cliff on June 30th. So we will be here another year, and staff is eager and excited to continue working and protecting the public. I do have one report on the number of dismissed complaints. I dismissed 15 cases since the last meeting. So those have been taken care of and addressed as well. And with that, that concludes my report.
Thank you. And thank you, staff, and Justin, Dr. Prod, Jean, everybody. Today was like a miracle, right? 3 years later, we're back in here looking at each other instead of seeing each other on TV. So we knew it was going to be hard, even though he did it the first time and it was spotless. So
it was just
so you guys don't drain a lot of energy. There's a lot of energy.
You don't have a big king chair.
No, I know.
Oh no, it should be sad. I can see it.
Yeah.
So anyway, we got to just keep doing this. It'll be more interactive, I think, once the students get back. But this was a good dry run, I would say.
So on that note, the next meeting will be a Friday meeting. It will be virtual. One reason is that this room is booked. So we'll be virtual on June 30th, and then in August will be the following meeting, and we'll be back in here all in person, hopefully with all the equipment.
Okay. Do we have a motion for adjournment?
Motion to adjourn.
Got a
second.
Motion?
Second.
Motion, second. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? None. Nobody's going to ever oppose. All right.
Thank you.
Mission for meetings.